Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to this Council on Foreign Relations Religion and Foreign Policy conference call. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We're delighted to have Kurt Martens with us today to discuss Pope Francis's leadership of the Catholic Church 1 year after his papal inauguration. Dr. Martens is an associate professor of canon law at the Catholic University of America, where he specializes in religious liberty and church-state relations. He is the editor of the Juris Studies in Church Law and Ministry. Welcome, Dr. Martens. Thank you very much for being with us today. It would be terrific if you could begin by giving us some background on Pope Francis' leadership, President Obama's recent trip to meet with him, and comment more broadly on the changes you have seen in the Vatican since Pope Francis's tenure began.
Well, thank you for having me this afternoon. I apologize in advance for my bad voice. I have a little bit of a cold, but I think that's not as important as this conference call. I will indeed start with a few remarks about Pope Francis' leadership. And the word I want to use to start with is the word change. Ever since Pope Francis was elected, we've heard this word change. The church has changed, the papacy has changed, etc. The question is that true? Or is that more style than content? I think it's more style than content. It's more an approach of the glass is half full rather than saying the glass is half empty. Because the Pope has been very clear that he's not changing church doctrine. He's not changing dogma. He just is a friendly man. He does things that some of his predecessors didn't do, or that not all of his predecessors did. Although he reminds us a lot of John Paul II, who was very outgoing, he reminds us also a little bit about the forgotten Pope, and I mean John Paul I, who died after only a month in office. So this perhaps is the papacy of John Paul I that was never finished, well, was finished too quick. So that's an introduction about that whole word of change, the meaning of change. I think we see a leader of the Roman Catholic Church who shows that he is strong when it comes to doctrine, but that he also shows that which the church is good at, to show forgiveness, to show mercy. It's interesting that this concept of change is always emphasized. People think that he's going to change the Roman Catholic Church. There's something else in his talking that is often overlooked. The way he emphasizes reconciliation and the sacrament of reconciliation, or if you wish, confession. His first Angelus from his private study overlooking St. Peter's Square was actually dedicated to asking for forgiveness, approaching the confessional to receive the sacrament of reconciliation. It's something we don't like to hear in the 21st century. However, he emphasized that too. Okay, that is with regard to change. There are two things that I would like to look at with regard to Francis, and then, of course, I'm open to any questions. First of all, with regard to the church at intra, and then secondly, with regard to the church at extra, that's where Obama and foreign policy comes in. With regard to the church at intra, we've seen a pope who is very simple, who emphasizes that the church has to give an example, that we shouldn't be too exquisite in our tastes. It's interesting. I've had a conversation over the summer with a good priest friend of mine who made a very interesting remark to me. I confronted him with what Pope Francis had said about priests who shouldn't be driving the fanciest cars and who shouldn't have the latest iPhone. I believe it's iPhone 5 he cited. And I said to that priest, who I knew had the latest iPhone, I said, and who I also knew was or is one of the most fervent supporters of Pope Francis, I said, well, didn't you hear what the Pope said? And he said, listen, he is a religious, he's a Jesuit, and I'm a secular priest. I don't need a religious to tell me how to live my life as a secular priest. So there is some not what he says about simplicity is not always well received also within the church, and sometimes is exaggerated. We have had a few let's say scandals or almost scandals recently when it came to residences of bishops and archbishops. We had a bishop in Germany who had to resign over enormous expenditures for the diocesan residence. There was the Archbishop of Atlanta who was under fire for building a residence. And there is another archbishop here in this country who is also brought into difficulties because of spending on his residence. What we forget about that is, yes, simplicity of life. On the other hand, though, when it comes to those residences, a residence of an archbishop or of a bishop, any official residence, is what you see on the outside might look very fancy, but when you come into the living quarters, it's not that much. What I want to say with that is, you have in such a residence, you have quarters that are private, very limited, very austere normally, but you have most of the space that's public to receive people, to entertain people because of your function. Personally, I would never like to live in such a residence because you're never alone, you're never in private. Same thing goes for the residence of Pope Francis. He chose to live in a another place than his predecessors. One can say it's for simplicity, perhaps, although the residence of Pope Benedict and John Paul II wasn't that luxurious. What you always saw on television were the state rooms, like you have them in the White House or in any other official building. That's not a place where someone lives. You don't want to have someone living there. There's always a cost involved, too, when it comes to residence. And for instance, when Pope Francis says, simplicity, I'm going to live a simple life or a life in common with other priests in the Domus at the other side of Vatican City State. Yes, but that comes with a cost, namely the cost of a residence that's not used and the cost of a residence that is now occupied and that cannot be rented out anymore. That's as far as simplicity is concerned. We also see that there is some call for reform of the Roman Curia. And everybody there kind of looks at structures and how structures need to be changed. I'm not so sure that the change of structures is the first thing that needs to be changed. It's interesting to see how people always join a party of Roman Curia bashing. That's always easy. However, what is the Roman Curia? It is an administration that is at the service of the Roman Pontiff to carry out his ministry of supreme shepherd of the church. Well, that should be the first guidance or the first principle when it comes to reform of the Roman Curia, rather than adjusting or changing structures. And that requires actually a conversion of the heart and of the mind. What do I mean by that? If the attitude of some who work in the Roman Curia is not changed, then it won't matter if you change structures. If careerism and other not-so-saintly principles keep being present, then nothing is going to change. Then you're going to have a new structure, but everything is going to be the same. So that is something that needs to be taken into account when we talk about reform of the Roman Curia. I see a tendency thus far where we want to throw out everything. However, that hasn't worked thus far. We've seen that the Vatican Bank has been under scrutiny, that the decision has been made to maintain the Vatican Bank, but at the same time that oversight is tightened and that all principles of modern governance of banking and international supervision are being applied. So I think that's a good evolution. You keep that which is good and you take out that which was bad. And I think that needs to be applied to the whole Roman Curia too. What does function, what does not function, but we need to keep in mind too that whenever it comes to an organization like this, an organization works with people who work for that organization. And if you don't make good selection of people, then your organization is not going to work. I think I'm running out of time. Let me look at the foreign policy for a minute. And first of all, the Obama visit. President Obama did visit with the Pope last month. And it was interesting to see that, first of all, the press release of the Holy See came out first. It was interesting to see what was emphasized there. President Obama said he was going to meet with the Pope because he admired the Pope and he wanted to talk about the poor. That seems to be the connecting point now between politicians and the Pope, because the Pope talks about the poor. And so that seems to be popular among politicians too. Well, interestingly enough, if you read the press release very carefully, the press release of the Holy See, what was included there was a discussion on questions of particular relevance for the church in the United States, namely the exercise of the rights to religious freedom, secondly, the life and conscientious objection, and the issue of immigration reform. Those three issues were emphasized in the press release of the Holy See. Rights to religious freedom, life and conscientious objection. Actually, that's a reference to the HHS mandate and the way the church here is objecting that. Immigration reform is the other important element in that press release that is underscored. So that is the message Pope Francis gave to President Obama. So what is important here to note is that the Pope and the American bishops are on the same wavelength. There is no rupture between them. They're defending the same principles. So if someone had hoped that there would have been a change with regard to that point, I don't think so. And actually, I did I just showed that I did major in math. There were two points in that press release: rights to religious freedom, life and conscientious objection, and the immigration reform. So not 3 points. I apologize for that. So I think that's an important issue to keep in mind, that the Obama visit was interpreted in different ways. One by the Obama administration, and the other way by the Holy See. And what the Holy See emphasized is not without importance. I think it is also important to look at pictures of that meeting. a look at the facial expression of the Pope when he met with President Obama, when official pictures were taken, I think that says more than 1,000 words. That is U.S. Holy See relations. There's another element that I want to that I would like to put forward here with regard to international foreign policy of the Holy See. Something that we probably forgot because it's been going on for so long. That is the conflict in Syria. In the fall, the Pope called for a prayer vigil on St. Peter's Square and a day of fasting and abstinence to prevent a war in Syria. That was not seen before and apparently has given a new boost to the diplomatic activity of the Holy See. And actually, it did work because an internationalization of the war in Syria was avoided. An escalation was avoided. The civil war still continues, unfortunately, but at least further escalation was avoided. So there you see the combination of prayer, personal involvement of the Pope, and the diplomacy of the Holy See leading to a good result. Now, one more point that I want to emphasize, and then I will stop. I see a parallel between Francis and Benedict. Both popes, although Pope Francis has been in office for just over a year, both popes have been subject of abuse of their words. We all do recall the so-called Regensburg talk, where Pope Benedict gave an academic talk at the University of Regensburg and then was attacked afterwards for things he had never said. Same thing happened actually to Pope Francis. On his way back from World Youth Days, he said on the plane, when asked about people with homosexual orientation, he said, "Who am I to judge?" Basically said nothing more than what is in the catechism of the church and what is in the teaching of the church. We care about those people. However, the actions cannot be approved. "Who am I to judge?" has been misinterpreted or, let's say, abused by people, even by legislators, in order to promote, for instance, gay marriage. Also in this country, even Catholic legislators have said, well, the Pope said, "Who am I to judge?" So it's okay now to vote in favor of. Well, that's a little bit too quick. He's never said that. So there, too, you see how certain expressions, certain sayings are abused, and where a pope is claimed to have said something he's never said. Anyhow, that's my introduction for today's conversation. I hope I wasn't too much over time. So I turn it back to you.
Thank you so much for that analysis and insight. Let's open it up then to questions from the group.
At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star 2. Please limit your questions to one at a time. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. And our first question comes from Donald Frew with the Covenant of the Goddess.
Thank you. As a bishop and a cardinal, Pope Francis had very friendly relations with the United Religions Initiative in Latin America. Do you see signs that he's going to continue or even expand a cordial relationship with interfaith organizations as Pope?
I think he will. Actually, that's been always the policy since Vatican II of the Holy See, with ups and downs, of course, but that's normal in human relations and in relations in, between faith groups. So you see two things. The Pontifical Council for Christian Unity and the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue continue their work of dialoguing with the, on the one hand, other Christian communities, on the other hand, with other faith groups, so non-Catholic, non-Christian communities, sorry. So, yes, I think he will do that. Pope Benedict did that in the past. John Paul II did that in the past. Paul VI did that in the past. So I don't see any indication why he would not continue that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question. Our next question comes from Ramdas Lam with the University of Hawaii.
Thank you, sir. This was I learned a lot this morning, and I think you have cleared up some misunderstandings of things that the Pope has said. And
thank
so
you.
I just want to. Yeah, no, you did a very good job. I appreciate it. And so my question really deals with the issue of religious freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there has been the impression that the Pope has said, you know, all religion, people of all religions, and even atheists have the potential to go to heaven. But I'm wondering, and it sounds like to me that you're saying that that's not actually the case. And that's what I'm really wanting to, just a bit of a clarification. So am I right in understanding what you have said, that in fact the Pope does not respect religious diversity and the idea that all people have the all people who are sincere and good people, irrespective of their belief system, can go to heaven?
I didn't say, you said something about religious liberty or religious beliefs.
Well, you had said that the Pope believed, when he was talking with President Obama, that that he is strong in his belief of the right to religious freedom.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, what does that mean in the sense of...
Okay, the right to religious...
Does he believe that people of all belief systems have a right to and can continue their beliefs, and that Christianity is not the exclusive key to heaven?
Okay, to answer that, and thank you for the clarification about your question, we have to look at... document of the Second Vatican Council on Religious Liberty, and that document actually emphasizes or actually summarizes the teaching of the Church on religious liberty. And basically what the Pope and the bishops here in the United States and elsewhere have been constantly saying is nothing more and nothing less than what is in that document, Dignitatis Humani, of the Second Vatican Council. What's in there? It starts with the dignity of each human person. And that's actually what the Pope has been saying also in other talks. And each human person has to be respected from his or her own dignity. And taking it from there, the state has a duty to protect the conscience of each individual and guarantee that there is religious liberty in all its aspects to search for the truth. And the document adds to it that ultimately there is the hope expressed that salvation, that they will ultimately come to the Catholic Church where they will find salvation.
So in other words, what he is reiterating is that without the Catholic Church, there is no salvation.
Well, he said some other things in some of his talks, and I thought it was a little bit, I don't know if they were off-cuff remarks or if they were remarks in another context or if they were taken out of context. So I don't know exactly what he meant by those remarks when he hinted to something into the other direction. So there, I don't know what he meant.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, our next question comes from Margaret Rose with the Episcopal Church.
Hi, you may know that today the Episcopal Church and the Roman Catholic Church in the U.S. released a joint statement called Ecclesiology and Moral Discernment, Seeking a Unified Moral Witness. And the two case studies that this group dealt with, one was immigration and migration, mm-hmm. and the other was questions around same-sex relations.
Yes.
And the conversation and the 6 years of work were really about discerning the ways each of our churches makes decisions, mm-hmm. and then trying to come to there from that point to some new ways of thinking and some new kinds of unity. And it occurs to me that this is somewhat the same as you're saying, style rather than content, but perhaps the first step in unity is about understanding the ways in which each of us really does do our work. I suppose that's a content, but I'd really like your comments on the ways the Holy Father might see this kind of work.
You mean the work that you're doing?
Well, not necessarily the work, but the pedagogy. Sort of learning to listen to the differences as well as the ways in which we are alike around decision making.
Well, I think your analysis is correct. Remember what I said earlier in the conversation or in my monologue when I started. He's a Jesuit. And they're very good when it comes to pedagogy. He is, you could see that he makes decisions, but there is a lot of consultation that comes before it. Consultation leading to discernment and to the ultimate decision. I think that's the way he wants to go. That's the way he probably sees also collegiality. Tell me not what I want to hear, but tell me what you think about this, so that I have some information, some input to make my final decision. He actually wrote that in some of his documents, that he doesn't want people, and he said it actually also in private and not so private conversations. He wants people to advise him. He doesn't want people to tell him what he likes to hear. And I think that is also true for the other, for the theme you touch upon, and for the methodology you're looking at. Does that answer the question?
Yes, I think so. I think it's a method, and that's one that I hope will get us into some new conversations that don't just do he said and he said or she said and she said.
Well, and that's the problem. But you see it already. One of the main problems we're confronted with when it comes to church is whether it's the Catholic Church or the Episcopalian Church, you probably have the same experience. When you're trying to convey messages to a broader audience, and especially no offense to journalists, it's taken its own way, and then quotes are taken out of context. The "who am I to judge" quotes is a good example thereof. The Regensburg talk of Pope Benedict was a good example thereof. Nobody bothered looking at the entire text, but everybody started commenting on it already. And if you don't know each other, if you don't listen, well, that's when you get into the he said, she said thing.
Right,
so,
right.
So I think it's indeed, yeah.
Okay, again. Do you have anything more to add to that, or should we go on to the next question?
Yeah, you can go on to the next question.
Great, thank you.
Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. And our next question comes from Brian Schmizik with Loyola University.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your remarks. I wanted to ask you, with this idea of the style over content, what do you make of the recent news article in National Catholic Reporter that Cardinal Maradiaga said that Francis is encountering opposition in the Curia?
That he's what?
that Francis is encountering opposition in the Curia, in the Roman Curia?
Well, there is a lot to say about Cardinal Maradiaga and what he says. A few remarks, and I'll try to be charitable. First of all, Cardinal Maradiaga has been put in a key position as the kind of leader of the group of eight cardinals who are helping the Pope reforming the Roman Curia. It's not good if you're in such a position and if you're constantly on the road and commenting on everything and anything. He made a very nasty comment about Cardinal Müller, who is the prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. Cardinal Müller had, in an article in L'Osservatore Romano, the newspaper of the Vatican, of the Holy See, at the request of Pope Francis, written a piece on the teaching of the Church on indissolubility of marriage and the consequences thereof. And Maradiaga said in an interview with a German newspaper, don't pay too much attention to Cardinal Müller. He's a German, he's a professor, and above all, a German professor, the worst you could have. Those comments do not help. And I'm wondering if it's Pope Francis who's encountering opposition, or whether the opposition is geared at Cardinal Maradiaga. There is another almost running joke going around. I'm sure you probably heard about Cardinal Bertone, who was the Secretary of State under Pope Benedict. And a number of people said that he was the cause of all problems, at least in the last years of the pontificate of Pope Benedict, because of all kinds of political and power games he was playing. True or false, I leave that aside. Cardinal Bertone was a Salesian. So is Cardinal Maradiaga. The running joke in Rome is now, well, the Pope replaced a problematic Salesian, Cardinal Bertone, with another problematic Salesian. So that is with regard to Cardinal Maradiaga. With regard to the Roman Curia, I can understand that there is opposition coming, and the opposition is not going to go away. It's going to become even more. Why? I think that a reform that needs to be carried out and that is needed needs to come, can only be successful if it comes also from inside and if it's also carried from inside. That being said, I don't think it's a good idea to reprimand the Roman Curia the whole time, saying, it's a bunch of old guys, they're only looking for their own comfort, this, that, and the other. I'm now exaggerating a little bit, but that's the image you got. They're all concerned about their own career, etc. I do happen to work as a kind of lawyer a lot with the various departments of the Roman Curia, especially those who handle canonical questions. And I must say, yes, you will find, as in any organization, you have it in a university too, you find careerism and you find people who are looking, while doing their current job, looking at a better position, etc., at climbing the system. However, there are a lot of very devout, the majority actually, very devout, very faithful people working there day and night, paid not much. I don't think it's fair to kind of chastise them the whole time. That in itself is going to trigger off some opposition. And then the other thing is, when I hear Cardinal Maradiaga say in interviews here and there that Pastor Bonus, which is the document governing the structure of the Roman Curia, is outdated and needs to be replaced, and it doesn't work anymore, then I wonder, has he ever read Pastor Bonus? Because if you look at the theology underpinning Pastor Bonus, and you look at what Pope Francis like wants to do with the Roman Curia, that's a perfect match. So why would you then replace that document? It comes back to a remark that I've already made. The change in the central administration doesn't come primarily from the change of structures, but will have to come, first of all, from a change of heart and mind, working for the Church Universal in particular churches. So, yeah, that's probably too much of a comment to that one question, but I think I needed to approach it from all aspects to give you a balanced answer.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you. And next question.
Our next question comes from J. Philip Ashe with the American Anglican Council.
Yes, Professor Martins, as a canon lawyer, do you see under the Holy Father any changes coming to either the canons or the judicial processes with regards to administrative and other recourse for laity who have concerns or grievances within the Church?
Wow, that's a very good question. You're touching there upon a very sore point, but it's also one of my research areas. And actually, the whole thing of recourse was the subject of my doctoral dissertation. So that being said, I could continue for another hour or two. But don't worry, I won't. I will try to be very brief. There are a number of things to be said there. I think all those recourses, hierarchical recourses, and we've seen them increase over the past two decades and even more over the past decades. I actually did one this morning myself. You see them in, for instance, cases of parish closures or church closures.
Yes.
You see that more and more faithful have recourse to Rome. And here is something interesting that comes up. I've heard bishops say, using what Francis said about decentralization, oh, those cases shouldn't go to Rome anymore. And there I say, well, perhaps that's an area where we need more centralization. Because who will watch the watchman? If your decisions at a local level are watertight, do you have any problem if they are reviewed by someone at a higher level? I wouldn't. I could make decisions that are canonically sound, that follow all procedures, and are also in conformity with canon law, within my rights, etc. I wouldn't have any problem with my decisions being reviewed. The fact that there is a tendency, I haven't heard it on these shores, but I've heard it in Europe, where bishops have been pleading or have been arguing in favor of decentralization, and that being one of the points to be taken away from Rome. Well, I've been too long in this business. If that's the argument that's being used, then something is wrong in the decision-making process, and that's a reason for not going forward with decentralization in that area. So I think Francis is probably open to that, and to recourses of faithful, but I do hope that faithful will also tell him that these systems of recourses need to continue to exist and need to even be expanded, so that the Holy See can continue to judge these cases.
Thank you. Next question.
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. And our next question comes from James Nuzzo with the Anglican Church of Canada.
Thank you very much, Professor. A question I have for you on more foreign policy-related issues. The last two pontificates have been very interested in opening relations with Orthodoxy, in particularly with the Russian Church. Given Kirill's sort of very tight relationship with Putin and what is going on in the Ukraine, do you think this is going to chill any opportunities for a opening with the Russian Church? Where do you see Orthodoxy and Roman Catholicism going in their dance for the next during this pontificate?
That's an excellent question. I don't have a crystal ball, so I'm not able to predict the future. However, there are a few elements here that I could give you as part of my response. I'm not so sure that which happens in Ukraine, that is necessarily a problem for Holy See relations with Moscow for a number of reasons. There are a few problems, though, because you have in Ukraine the Ukrainian Catholic Church, and of course that's a very sensitive issue, so the Holy See will be very reluctant to at least get officially involved, I think. On the other hand, though, I've heard officials of the Secretariat of State say, oh, the record when it comes to Putin and what happened with the Olympics and then later onwards with that was just prior before the war or the annexation of Crimea started. I've heard them say, well, who says that Putin is wrong? Of course, what was the background of that was Putin was one of the only world leaders who didn't want to join this call for gay marriage as a civil right. And so I think it's the answer, I can't say yes or no what's happening there. We're in a gray zone, and it's going to be, we'll have to wait and see what's happening.
Do you know if the conversations towards what was considered to be a very strong possibility in 2015 or 2016 for the Pope to make a visit to Moscow, whether those have been are continuing or whether that they've been placed on the back burner?
As far as I know, they have not been placed on the back burner, but then again, I'm not part of those conversations, so I cannot tell for sure. I do know that there has been, on the part of the Holy See, a strong desire to reach out to the Russian Orthodox Church, and sometimes, as it always goes in politics, even church politics, the higher good is more important than the lower good. So we will have to see how that plays out. And remember, we're 2014, 2015, 2016. That's a long way from now.
Right. Thank you
Certainly
very much.
In politics, yeah. You're welcome.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Fabio Petito with the University of Sussex.
Thank you for your comments.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Can I go back to your overall argument, which I tend to agree with, about change?
Yes.
I think you're right in saying that there is no change in terms of structure that possibly there is a change in terms of style. But I also think that there might be some more significant change in terms of the governance of the church. And I'd like to know what you think about that. It seems to me that this Pope has shown a clear, how can I put it, distaste for the understanding of the Vatican, the papacy as a monarchy, and the idea of cardinal as prince. This kind of, very peculiar historical connection between church, the papacy, a state, and so on. And even in his choice of his name, Francis, he seems to strongly believe that this is not necessary for the church in this form. Of course, the church needs to have, some tools to govern itself.
Yes,
but
correct.
We have, it's not appropriate. And I think he's probably committed to change this quite drastically. Now, this goes also, in my view, in another direction. That this is, and this we shouldn't be forgetting this. This is a first non-European pope.
I do not agree with that, though.
The first point.
No, I don't agree with the fact that this is the first non-European pope.
No, it's.
I would say we have again an Italian pope.
Of course, it's.
He happened to spend most of his life in Argentina.
Yeah. I mean, I think...
No, I've taken you.
Yeah, no,
I'm sorry for interrupting you.
Clearly Argentinian. Of course Argentinian, half of the Argentinians are Italian descent, that's known. But I think...
it's interesting...
You would undervalue... I disagree, if I can finish.
Yeah.
I think in terms of his cultural references, of course he has a lot of Italian knowledge, but he has a deep cultural connection with the Latin American popular cultures, and I think this makes him look at the church from the perspective of the global South and the non-European world, and I at least gives him the sense that the church need to readjust, reorient its governance structure in a way that reflects this reality.
Yeah.
I think that will. I mean, he will try, in my view, to change the governance structure of the church in a way that gives more space also to non-European cultures in some way. And finally, I think another point to that and goes to the discussion about the orthodoxy. It was very clear at his acceptance, the first contact with the Roman people in St. Peter's Square, when he said that, first of all, he was the Bishop of Rome. And he was not the head of the... He was the head of the Catholic Church because he was the Bishop of Rome. That was a very powerful sign for the Orthodox churches. In fact, and it was something that, other popes have said, John Paul II, of course, and even Benedict. But I think it speaks also to his great commitment to try to be open as to the possibility of even changing concretely the understanding of the working of the Pope in relationship to the Orthodox sister churches. And I think there is this understanding on the side of the Orthodox churches at the moment. Of course, there is also a very different context which might allow this to happen that wasn't there with John Paul II, and in some way with Benedict. Sorry for the long question, but I'd like to know what you think about this.
Well, I could not agree more about a Bishop of Rome. Who do the cardinals elect when they're in the Sistine Chapel? They elect a new Bishop of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the primacy of the Bishop of Rome, he is the head of the College of Bishops and thus the head of the Church Universal. And not the other way around. During this conclave and also the conclave that elected Benedict, I had to explain that multiple times to journalists, and they kept saying, they're electing the head of the Catholic Church. Theologically, that's wrong. And if that would have been an exam, they would have flunked the exam. Anyhow, so what he said there was theologically sound, as we find it in documents of the councils, as we find it in the Code of Canon Law, etc. So I don't see any problem with that. Will he change the rest? I'm not so sure about those things. I think he takes a lot of consultation, and as one of the other persons who intervened, I forget who it was, who mentioned something about opposition within the Roman Curia, as we go forward, the ideas that have been put out, they're subject to criticism, they're subject to revision, they're subject to a number of things, and he takes it in, he listens, and then makes up his mind, makes a decision. So I'm not so sure that we're going to go that fast, that we're going to see a radical change of the papacy. I'm not so sure he knows it himself, which direction he wants to go. The other question that we don't know is, he is 77 years old. We don't know how much time he has. We also do not know what his health condition is. There are two unknown factors. And so we don't know how much time he has in office and where that might lead us. So, yeah, you never know. So time and the input from others might give a different outcome. I didn't answer the question the way you wanted, but...
it's fine. Can I just say about the monarchic nature of
yes.
the papacy? I think that's an interesting point. What do you
yeah.
think about that?
That's a very well. That's interesting also because we are always saying that the church is very hierarchical. I always laugh, especially when lawyers try to argue that in court cases that it's top-down.
Mm-hmm.
There is no organization where it's less hierarchical than in the church.
I agree with that. The monarchic nature doesn't speak to that.
No, and the monarchic nature is the same thing. I hear that from people who criticize the way the Roman Curia works, etc., etc., but is that really the case? Is that really a monarchic system? No. You have a structure in place, but then every pope is different. Look at the popes since Vatican II, John the 23rd, Paul the 6th, John Paul the 1st, as brief as he was pope, John Paul the 2nd, Benedict the 16th, and Francis the 1st. These are all different characters and different personalities, and they all carried the papacy in a different way. You can't say that they did it in the same way. I'm not so sure that that's even the concept of a monarchy or monarchic nature is a true or correct concept. It might be an perception.
I think we have time for one more question.
Okay, our last question comes from Tanis Yusup with the Friends of United Nations Alliance of Civilizations.
Hi, Professor Martin. Thank you very much for your interesting talk. I just have two very quick questions. You mentioned your friend, and you described him as a, quote, secular priest, unquote. And
yes.
I didn't really get what that meant. I don't know whether you meant a parish priest. And my second question was, returning to the foreign policy issue, do you know who is advising the Pope on his visit to the Holy Land? As you know, when Pope Benedict went to when he, before he made that speech in Regensburg, he had apparently sidelined the major Muslim expert he had sent him to Egypt or something. So some people like John Esposito suggested that that was the reason why his statements may have been misinterpreted or made wrongly. Thank you.
Just a clarification about terminology. You have secular priests, meaning clergy incarnated in a diocese, and religious priests, that are those belonging to a religious order, like Jesuits, Franciscans, and whatnot. Secular priests did not make any vows, while religious priests usually have obedience, poverty, and celibacy. So that's the difference. That's what I wanted to say. And basically, the example was my friend said, but I'm a diocesan priest. I'm not a religious. If I wanted to be religious, I would have chosen for that life. I haven't. He is a religious, so he can... That was my point that I was trying to make. I don't know who is advising the Pope on his visit to the Holy Land. Normally, such things should be coordinated by the Secretariat of State. I said should be, because that's where it went wrong in Regensburg. The text should have been screened or looked at by the Secretary of State or his collaborators, that was Cardinal Sodano, and he didn't, or neglected it, or whatever, and so that's where text went, where the whole incident started. Although, if you read the text as such, he was making a positive statement, but as a professor with a methodology that you could use in a classroom, in an auditorium, by asking a rhetorical question, citing an author, and then saying that argument doesn't fly, but try to sell that to the streets.
Thank you very much, Dr. Martins. I think we've reached the end of our hour, but we appreciate your taking the time today
and
share your valuable insights with us.
You're most welcome.
And to everybody for their terrific questions and comments. I think it was a productive call. So I hope that you will email us at outreach@CFR with any suggestions and topics you would like to have us look at for future conference calls. And we hope that you will continue to participate in this series. So thank you, and thank you, Dr. Martin.
You're most welcome.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.